Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in view, but the sun is a crisp by the moon. And hello there, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Astronomy Show, where we bring you the latest news and discoveries from all corners of the universe here in 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm John Dixon. Good evening to you again. And you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie or astronomy.ie or as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. We're all out there. We welcome any queries, comments or questions that you may have of an astronomic nature. And our email address, astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. You can also get us on the text line or the WhatsApp line, the same number, 087-179-1032. So, there we go. Very good evening to you again. Now, where is the moon tonight? Moonrise, unfortunately, out of sight this evening. It's what we call a full new moon, which means it's not visible at the moment. So as the weeks progress over the next couple of weeks, we will get to see it getting larger and larger and larger. And it's always a competition for those of you who like to try and catch the moon with that little crescent thumbnail type thing about 2 days, 2 to 3 days in, which is one of my favorite times to see the moon. So we'll keep an eye out for that as well. Sunrise. Now, tomorrow morning, sunrise at 7:37 a.m. and setting it at 17:41, that's 21 minutes to 6. And daylight hours, 10 minutes, 4 seconds and 30, 10 minutes, 4 minutes and 37 seconds. Or should I say 10 hours, there you go. Plus 4.04 minutes a day, we're getting extra daylight at the moment. You probably noticed an extra sort of stretch in the evening, as Ben likes to call it. And we, over the next coming week, we stretch from 4 minutes and 4 seconds to 4 minutes and 10 seconds. So we're getting brighter and brighter in the evening time as well. Noticeably a little bit in the morning as well. It is noticeable now as sort of, well, we call it summer. Summer's approaching. It's going to be spring next anyway. So that's something to look forward to. Our International Space Station, unfortunately, is not in our evening skies at the moment. There are some morning passes. I don't have time for those just at the moment. But again, March the 11th to March the 28th is the time slot for catching the evening International Space Station. Again, as we get the times, we shall inform you of that as well. Now, a city on the moon. This is why SpaceX has shifted its focus from Mars. It's the world's richest man has repeatedly said that he founded SpaceX back in 2002, primarily to help settle on the red planet. That was his mission. And the company's website places Mars front and center all the time, explaining why the fourth rock from the sun is the best target for human exploration and expansion. Musk has generally been dismissive of other off-Earth options. The moon, being named as one of them. Just 13 minutes ago, for example, he stressed that SpaceX will go straight to Mars, declaring that Earth's natural satellite a distraction. But I think things have changed a little bit now, but over the weekend Musk threw a little curveball into this, announcing that SpaceX is now centering its settlement plans on the moon, at least in the short term as well. For those unaware, SpaceX has already shifted focus to building a self-growing city on the moon, as we can potentially achieve that in less than 10 years, is what he's saying, whereas Mars would take 20-plus years. And the billionaire wrote on Sunday afternoon, last week, on his social media platform he bought in 2022. The mission of SpaceX remains the same, to extend consciousness and life as we know it into the stars. I think it's brilliant as well, so. And he also mentions it's only possible to travel to Mars when the planets align every 26 months, a 6 month trip time, whereas we can launch to the moon every 10 days, which is a 2 day trip time. It took Apollo, of course, 3 days to get there. And this means we can iterate much faster and complete a moon city than a Mars city. So let's just keep our eyes peeled for this particular one as well. So there he is. He's shifted his direction a little bit away from Mars and is planning more to go to the moon. So a launch just a few days ago on February the 13th into the 14th. NASA launched four astronauts to the International Space Station just on Friday, and the latest team to head out on the research expedition to the orbiting laboratory. And the US Space Agency's International Crew 12 lifted off at approximately 5:15 a.m., which is 10:15 GMT. On this side of the world, they brought the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from the Cape Canaveral launch site in Florida. So the astronauts will replace the crew that returned from the station early due to a medical issue a few weeks back with one of its members. Now, we didn't hear too much about that. I've been scouring it as well to see if we can get any sort of inclination as to who or what happened, but we just don't know yet. But no doubt something will come out into the media shortly. So the pre-dawn launch was delayed by 2 days over the adverse weather condition forecast in the US East Coast, and eventually it docked on St. Valentine's Day to boost the skeleton crew, who were down to three at the time. Must have been a bit eerie up there, so playing tag and hide and seek and all sorts of things I'm sure they were doing as well. So anyway, SpaceX Crew's 12 astronaut mission docked with the short-staffed International Space Station on Saturday, February the 14th at 2015 GMT, just quarter past eight, ending a 34-hour orbital chase. Now, it was quite a slow particular one. Sometimes they can do in 5-6 hours. With that gentle contact, they have bridged the legacies of humankind's continuous presence in space, and it's been more than 25 years at this very site. The International Space Station is more than a structure. It is a promise kept decades in the making, built by nations, sustained by trust and partnerships, and powered by science and innovation, and of course, curiosity as well. So, congratulations to them. So another pile up there. So the space station is now, well, I won't say full, but it's certainly got a few extra crew members as well. Now, I don't know if you noticed that if you are in the Ring of Fire, which is the annular solar eclipse, we would have missed this. And if you're only in Antarctica, this was the path of annularity. This is roughly 2,661 mile long and 383 mile wide corridor where the moon covers about 96% of the sun's disk. And that was earlier on this morning. It started at our time here at just 4:10 a.m. The maximum Ring of Fire annularity was at 12:12 GMT, and the partial eclipse ended at 14:27 GMT. It's a pity we missed it, but seemingly more penguins got to see that than humans as well. So it's a very small region of Antarctica. It lies in the path of annularity. Viewers elsewhere in Antarctica and across parts of southern Africa and southernmost South America got to see a partial solar eclipse rather than the full total one, or just about the one that they got down in Antarctica. It's a pity, but we will get one back again. Now, I've been asked this a number of times. What would happen to the unprotected human body in space now? There's a daunting thing. So we're just not built for space. What would happen if a human was fired out of an airlock? There's a big question for you. It's a recurring horror in sci-fi. The hull is pierced. A human is trapped without equipment in an airlock about to open. The door needs to be opened in order to expel something undesirable. With no air and almost zero pressure, the human body, believe it or not, is not going to last too long without some sort of protection. And the first thing you would notice, and I don't particularly want to notice this myself, is the lack of air. You would not lose consciousness straight away. It might take up to 15 seconds as your body uses up the remaining oxygen reserves from your bloodstream. And if you don't hold your breath, you could perhaps survive as long as 2 minutes without permanent injury. And the reason for this is that if you do hold your breath, the loss of external pressure would cause the gas inside your lungs to expand, which would rupture the lungs and release air into the circulatory system. The first thing you do, if you ever find yourself suddenly expelled into the vacuumous space, is to exhale. It's less painful. And the other things you can't really do much about, after about 10 seconds or so, your skin and tissue underneath will begin to swell as the water in your body starts to vaporize in the absence of atmospheric pressure. You will not balloon to the point of exploding like you may see on some of the films that you get on telly if they're on Mars and the likes of. And since the human skin is actually strong enough to keep from bursting, but if you were brought back to the atmospheric pressure, your skin and tissue would return to normal as long as you weren't out there for too long. It will not affect your blood since the circulatory system is able to keep blood pressure regulated unless you go into absolute shock. The motion of your tongue would begin to boil. This is horrible. And who was exposed to near vacuum in the test chamber in 1965? His name was Jim LeBlanc. And LeBlanc's suit sprung a leak and he remained conscious for about 14 seconds. And he says his last sensation was bubbling of his tongue. And he was safely revived as the researchers began repressurizing the chamber almost immediately after about 15 seconds. And because you will be exposed to unfiltered cosmic radiation, this is something else, you can expect some nasty sunburn and you'll probably get a case of decompression sickness. You would not, however, freeze straight away despite the extreme cold temperatures. Heat does not leave the body quickly enough for you to freeze before you suffocate. And due to the lack of both convection and conduction. So, if you do die in space, your body will not decompose in the normal way, since there is no oxygen. If you were near a heat source, you would just become mummified. If you were not, it would just freeze in about 45 minutes or thereabouts. And if your body was sealed in a spacesuit, it would decompose only as long as the oxygen landed, whichever condition. It's not pleasant. You just do not want to be anywhere near that. So just in case you were interested as what might happen if you were exposed to the vacuum of space. Talking about life, life on Earth is lucky. This is a rare chemical fluke and it may have made our planet habitable. And without the right oxygen balance, phosphorus and nitrogen vanish and life cannot take hold. So they're saying, all the experts saying that life on Earth may exist thanks to an incredible stroke of luck, a chemical sweet spot that most planets miss during the formation, but ours managed to hit. Yep, we've got this thing we're in called the Goldilocks zone, which is not too far, not too close to the sun, etc. and all that. So, and we know that the precise set of chemical conditions that allowed it to retain two elements essential for life as we know it, that is phosphorus and nitrogen. Without a perfect balance of these elements, a rocky planet could appear habitable on the surface, yet be fundamentally incapable of supporting biology. So, yeah, there's lots of reading on this particular thing as well. If you want to get in at it, it's just headed Life on Earth is Lucky, if you want to have a little read of that one as well. So, we formed, as we know, as some of us do, nearly 4.6 billion years ago. And the new findings could change how scientists search for alien life. And this is going on day by day, week by week, year by year, etc. So something, a spot of luck, I think. I was just looking at a picture of some of the penguins with sunglasses seeing their solar eclipse this morning. My goodness. Okay. So anyway, you're tuned to the Astronomy Show right here, 103.2 Dublin City FM. Very good evening to you. Thanks for tuning our way. I'm just slipping over to a little planet that we know as Venus. And they now say that they may have an underground tunnel carved by volcanic eruptions. And scientists analysing decades of old data from the NASA's Magellan mission say that they have identified what appears to be a vast underground tunnel carved by volcanic activity on Venus. And this is great. The technology able to beam things down to the surface of Venus as well. And the finding also contributes to a growing body of evidence challenging the long-held view of Venus as a geologically dead world. Another unpleasant place to be is there as well. So we'll see if we can get some more information on that over the next number of years. So now we had another rocket launch carrying 32 satellites for Amazon LEO network into space. This is the most powerful version of Europe's Ariane rocket 6. And this was just last Thursday, carrying 32 satellites into space for the Amazon LEO network. Not a name that is too familiar out there just at the moment. And this one particularly aims to rival Elon Musk's Starlink missions and the launch from the European Space Port in Kourou in French Guiana on the northeastern coast of South America is first for Amazon LEO. So this is brilliant. It's the largest number of satellites ever carried by the Ariane rocket successfully separated and set off towards their final orbit to a big round of applause from those following the event live at the control center. And this word of the day, or the line of the day, what a day, what a launch, claimed Ariane CEO David Carvoilis, who said the operation proved the launcher's ability to carry out the most complex mission. So that's something to look forward to as well. That's, again, the name is Amazon LEO, and we have, of course, Elon Musk as well doing his stuff to launch things into space, satellites and things to go around the moon, back again, and send signals here, there and everywhere, take photographs, you name it. Now, why do solar and lunar eclipses come in pairs? And what an eclipse season really is. Now, eclipses don't just happen at random. They arrive in pairs and on schedule all the time. The 2026 brings two spectacular seasons to prove it. And we tend to hear about solar and lunar eclipses only in the days before they happen, often with the impression that they are unfolding in a far-off or exotic parts of the world. And for months, the sky followers and the followers follow the familiar rhythm of the new and full moons, and then seemingly, out of nowhere, the sky delivers two major eclipses just weeks apart. And in reality, eclipses are neither random nor one-off events, as I've just mentioned. Every eclipse is part of a predictable pattern, and they almost arrive and always arrive in pairs during a short and recurring window known as the eclipse season. And this year, 2026, will produce two eclipses separated by exactly 2 weeks, and an annular solar eclipse followed by a total lunar eclipse. And as we get to know when these are going to happen, we'll keep you informed on this. And the particular eclipse season is a period between 31 and 37 days during which eclipses become possible. And the seasons occur about every 173 days, or roughly twice a year. So that's why they come in pairs. Why are the launch windows for NASA's Artemis II mission so short? That's the big question as well. NASA, of course, is gearing up to launch the Artemis II. This is the first crewed mission to the moon in more than half a century. We've missed a couple of launch windows at this stage. Back in February, there was one launch window between the 6th and 9th of March. There was one on March the 11th. And 6 will be available in April. That's the 1st, the 3rd to the 6th, and April the 30th. So with a bit of luck, we'll get somewhere near to those dates. The liftoff window lasts 120 minutes on all of these dates, except for March 11 when it was 115 minutes long, so they missed that particular one as well. So that works out to just 11 opportunities over a 61-day stretch, and some of them may be nixed by bad weather, which they were, and they might need to replenish commodities like rocket fuel. And this is just the technicalities that sort of go against launching as well. So Artemis 2, when it does get off, it's going to lift off from Kennedy Space Center in Florida, sending Canadians astronaut Jeremy Hansen and NASA Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover and Christina Koch on a roughly a 10-day trip around the moon aboard the Orion crew capsule. So looking forward to that. And they must be in the particular proper alignment to get that away. So the launch windows are quite short, which is really weird. Well, I suppose it's not weird at all. So anyway, you're listening to The Astronomy Show right here in 103.2 Dublin City FM. John Dixon here until 8 p.m. Thank you indeed for your company. And the text line, 087-179-1032 if you'd like to say hi to anyone or ask a question. So we'll keep an eye on that one for you as well. Now, Titan may have formed in a giant impact between ancient Saturn moons, is what they're saying now. We have recent modelling work suggesting that Saturn's largest moon in Titan may be the product of a violent collision between two earlier moons rather than the relic left over from the system's formation. And in this scenario, the large proto-Titan and a smaller proto-Hyperion merged in a giant impact that reshaped Titan, erased many of its impact craters, and helped to set up the conditions that later produced Saturn's bright rings. So that's pretty exciting as well. Now, what is a conjunction? We often hear the word. The sky is full of movement, as we know, and when one astronomical object appears to pass close by another, it produces a conjunction, which is realistically just a meeting in the sky, and it's when two astronomical units appear close to each other in the sky. The bodies involved can be the sun, the moon, a planet, or even a star, and although the objects appear to be close, this is just an illusion caused by the perspective, and during a conjunction, Earth forms an almost straight line with the two other bodies, and this is where we get this word conjunction from. And it looks like they meet in the sky. In reality, the two bodies are separated by vast distances, and the sun, the moon, and the planets are always on the move. And technically speaking, therefore, a conjunction will only last for an instant. There are a number of ways to define a conjunction, of course, and one way is to say it is the movement or minimum separation between two objects as viewed here from Earth. And however, from sky watchers, the event plays out over a number of nights, which is quite a fun thing to watch. So if you ever hear us mentioning conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, or Sun and the Earth and the Moon, etc., take note and see if you can get to see them through a pair of binoculars or a telescope as well. So that's what a conjunction is. So why do they happen? That's the question. So the solar system is the shape of a thin disk. The Earth, the Moon, and the planets orbiting the Sun is roughly the same plane. Astronomers call this plane the elliptic because the alignment, the Sun, the Moon, and five planets visible to the naked eye, namely Mercury, Venus, means. Now, could the Milky Way's galaxy, supermassive black hole, actually be a clump of dark matter? There's a question. This has been asked only in the last few days, probably namely a lot longer than that, but we are not just replacing the black hole with a dark object. We are proposing that the supermassive central object is the same galaxy's dark matter halo after the two manifestations of the same continuous substance. Sorry, this one's just a little bit off the scale on my sort of reading as well. So there you are. Is it a black hole really, or is it just a clump of dark matter, or is it still a black hole? Sagittarius A, that's what it's called. That includes the violent and rapid distance the stars taking place in the galactic center, which is so-called S stars race around the compact heart of the galaxy as speeds of greater than 67 million miles per hour. So, there's something to look at as well. Now, do you ever wonder what you might weigh on other planets? So, just say, for example, you weighed, we go for 100 kilos, thereabouts. So if you weighed 100 kilos on Earth here, on Mercury, because of the size of the planet, you would only weigh 37.8 kilos. If you're on Venus, because Venus is much the same size as Earth, you would weigh 90.7. And with the Moon and Mars, your weight, the Moon, you would weigh 16 kilos. And this is why the bounce around on the Moon when they're up there, just bouncing up and down, so they're only 16.6 kilos. Your weight on Mars would be 37.7 kilos. And your weight on Jupiter, because it's so massive, would be 236.4 kilos. Your weight on Saturn, it's quite large as well. Your weight would be 106.4. Uranus is slightly smaller than Earth, so you'd only weigh 88.9. And your weight in Neptune is 112.5 kilos, so a little bit larger than Earth as well. There are a couple of moons of Jupiter up there as well. Io being one of them, your weight would be 18.35 kilos if you're in Europa, 13.35 kilos if you're in Ganymede, 14.48, and Callisto, 12.64. Now, there are a number, a good number of moons around Jupiter as well. So, the big burning question from the big burning star, our sun, your weight would be 2,707.2 kilos. Yes, indeed. Now, there we go. Now, I was looking for something earlier on. I just forgot to mention, actually. Where are the planets just at the moment? So let's just have a quick look to see where they are in our evening skies at the moment. Mercury is becoming visible in the low southwest just after sunset at the moment. Binoculars will actually help on this. And it's getting a little higher every evening while remaining a bright magnitude 1 all of this week and probably all of next week as well. Venus, it's a little bit lower down below Mercury. It's also much brighter at magnitude -3.9. Now, that is quite bright as planets go, but it has to contend with the worst horizon obstructions and strong atmospheric extinctions. And it's also creeping up as much more slowly day by day. Venus is just 8 degrees below Mercury on the 13th. Now, that was a couple of days ago, so it's there or thereabouts. And if you want to see it, as they say, good luck. Mars, unfortunately, is still out of the sight, our sight here, just behind the glare of the sun. And Jupiter, magnitude -2.6. It's up all night. It comes up in the middle of Gemini. That's Castor and Pollux. You can spot it very high in the east-southeast as twilight fades. And it's the first star-like object of the evening. Jupiter shines highest in the south by about 9 p.m. at the moment. It's a fantastic sight. Saw it again last night. Was out there for... in and out like a yo-yo, you know, just because it gets cold. It was cold last night. And Saturn is a little bit dimmer, plus 1.1. It's in Pisces. Uranus, 5.7. Very, very difficult to see. You won't get to see it with the human eye. And you've got to use a telescope or a very, very, very good pair of binoculars. And Neptune is a telescopic object of 7.9, near declining Saturn as well. Anyway, that's it from me for this evening. Thank you indeed for joining me. That email address again for comments and questions is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. And Ben and myself will be back, and we forgot to thank James Connor and for putting it on the astronomy website, etc. And that's all from me, John Dixon, for this particular edition of the Astronomy Show. And now it's music all the way until 2 a.m. right here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Next, Dublin's Greatest Hits, 10 p.m. till midnight, Ear to the Globe with Nigel Wood, with his world of music. Midnight After Hours with Dave Barry, his jazz, blues and soul until 2 a.m. So please join myself and Ben, same time, next week, 7:30. I will be back with the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. And thank you indeed for listening. And say good night, John. Good night, John. See ya. Bye-bye.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.